page 354, chapter 15, Slavery and Sectionalism. Chapter Preview, Terms, Antebellum, Abolitionist, Driver, Arson, Urban, Rural, Sectionalism, Tariff, Slave State, Free State, Missouri Compromise, Nullification, State's Rights, Underground Railroad, Annex, Manifest Destiny, Free Soil, Popular Sovereignty, Compromise of 1850, Georgia Platform, Kansas-Nebraska Act, Border State. People: William and Ellen Craft, Henry Clay, John C. Calhoun, William Lloyd Garrison, Alexander Stevens, Howell Cobb, Robert Toombs, James Buchanan, Dred Scott, John Brown, Joseph E. Brown, Thomas R. R. Cobb, Linton Stevens, Benjamin Hill, Herschel Johnson. Places: Texas, Kansas. A great African-American poet of the 20th century, Langston Hughes, called the institution of slavery the American heartbreak, rock on which freedom stumped its toe. Understanding slavery and its effects is still a challenge. Much of Georgia's wealth was based on the labor of enslaved people. The number of slaves increased throughout the period historians call the antebellum or pre-Civil War period of U.S. history. The word comes from Latin. Ante means before, and bellum means war. By 1860, almost 500,000 slaves lived in Georgia, making up over 40% of the state's population. Almost 60% of Georgia's slaves were on plantations with more than 20 slaves. Toiling in the rice fields of the coast and the cotton fields across the middle of the state, slaves cultivated the cash crops that made their owners wealthy people. They also worked in their owners' houses as servants and in their shops as craftsmen. Unlike most other immigrants to the United States, the migration of Africans to this country was forced on them. But they created lives for themselves as best they could under the limitations they had. They survived their hard lives and lack of freedom by forming families and friendships and by relying on religious faith. Some even resisted by running away or, in rare cases, planning rebellion or revolt. As the institution of slavery grew in the South, opposition to it grew in the North. The anti-slavery movement, including the abolitionists who wanted to do away with slavery throughout the United States, became an important cause for many Northerners. Others did not believe slavery could be abolished where it already existed, but they also did not want it to expand into new areas. Slavery eventually became an issue in politics. Sectional tension between the North and South became stronger and stronger. By the late 1850s, the two areas of the country were on the road that led to war. Page 356, Section 1, Slavery in Georgia. As you read, look for Daily Life for Slaves in Georgia, How Slaves Fought Back Against Slavery, Terms, Driver, Arson. Slaves in Georgia all lived under the same set of laws about slavery, called the Slave Code. They all lacked the freedom to make most decisions about their lives and where and how they would spend them. Although the lives of slaves had these similarities, the everyday lives of individual slaves were affected by many different influences. No factor in a slave's well-being was more important than his or her owner. The amount of food and clothing, the quality of housing, the likelihood of being able to stay with family members, and the amount of punishment could all vary by the kindness, neglect, or greed of an owner. Other factors that affected how slaves lived included where in Georgia they were, how large the farms or plantations were, and how much time they had away from whites to create a culture and community of their own. Men and women had different experiences in slavery. Women were expected not only to work, but also to produce many children. In this section, we will explore life for enslaved people in pre-Civil War Georgia and examine all these factors. Work. An individual slave spent most of the day working. The majority of slaves were field slaves, which meant they worked planting, tending, and harvesting the crops they grew for their owners, especially the cash crops. How they worked depended on which crop they grew, and that depended on where the plantations were. Rice grew in the tidal areas of the coast. Growing rice required a great deal of work, which meant that not enough rice could be grown by a small farmer to be profitable. Therefore, rice was grown on large plantations with many slaves. Rice plantations used the task system, where each day a specific amount of work, usually in a portion of a rice field, was assigned to each slave. Once that work was completed, the slaves had time for themselves. Average task assignments had slaves working from 8 to 10 hours a day. Those who worked fast finished early, so the task system had the benefit of giving the slaves time that many used to grow extra food for themselves and their families. Work on rice plantations, however, was very difficult. Rice fields had to be flooded with water off and on during the growing period. Slaves did their work while standing in water that might also harbor snakes and alligators. Rice fields were breeding grounds for mosquitoes, which carry disease. Both men and women worked in the fields, given tasks based on what owners or overseers, supervisors, thought them capable of doing. Children usually received their first tasks around age 10. Cotton plantations were different. Slaves worked on the gang system, where work was based on time. Men and women planted, tended, or harvested cotton in groups or gangs from sunup to sundown. This is what slaves sometimes called can see to can't see. Those on the gang system had no hope of extra time for themselves, no matter how fast they worked. In fact, to make sure they kept a steady pace, slaves under the gang system worked under the watchful eyes of overseers and drivers, older slaves the plantation owner thought were loyal. If the slaves worked too slowly, they were often punished, especially by being whipped. Although most slaves worked in the fields, a few worked as house servants and some were artisans. The larger the plantation, the more servants and artisans it might have. House servants included butlers, coachmen, housekeepers, cooks, seamstresses, gardeners, and women who cared for the white children in the family. Some house servants slept in the main house, sometimes on cots in the hall or in the rooms with children under their care. Most slaves, however, had cabins away from the main house. On large plantations, the quarters where they lived was similar to a small village. On some plantations, families could have a small garden plot to raise extra food. Cabins were usually one room, simple, with few pieces of furniture. Owners provided basic food rations and handed out clothing each year. In the hot summers, slaves did not wear shoes, although most got a pair of shoes for the winter. In spite of the lack of possessions, slaves did create meaning for their lives. In their quarters, friendships were made, music was played and sung, stories were told, and prayers were said. Family and religion. Two important aspects of life for many slaves were family and religion. A slave marriage was not a legal marriage with a license from the courthouse, but many slaves considered themselves married to their partners. Many owners encouraged those relationships and sometimes had wedding ceremonies. Owners thought that couples made slave communities more stable. Owners also wanted their slave women to have children because that increased their slave population without their having to buy additional slaves. Since the slave relationships did not have the legal status of marriage, owners could still separate the couple by selling one of them. Separation from family was one of the greatest fears of slaves. In spite of these difficulties, enslaved men and women did form loving households and usually stayed together if they could. Sometimes slaves married partners who lived on nearby plantations, so they saw each other mainly on Sundays and perhaps at night. Sometimes a slave would marry a free black person. Those marriages were usually between two partners who lived in a town. Religion was also an important part of the lives of many slaves. Most had religious services on plantations, although some attended churches with their owners. Churches of this period had both black and white members, although many sanctuaries had separate balconies where the slaves and free blacks sat. Some towns had independent black churches where slaves could worship more freely without their owners around. Such churches were sometimes required to have a white person present to make sure no rebellions were plotted. Wherever they worshiped, religion offered comfort, and for some slaves, the hope of justice, if not on earth, then in heaven. Masters, on the other hand, saw religion as a way of controlling slaves by emphasizing parts of the Bible that stressed obedience and meekness. Slave laws and resistance to slavery. In 1833, Georgia passed a new slave code. These laws affected many aspects of slaves' lives. Because slave owners in Georgia and other southern states believed that uneducated slaves were easier to control, it was illegal to teach slaves to read and write. No slaves were allowed to work in print shops. They could not own property. They also could not travel without written passes from their owners. There were many crimes that could result in a slave's execution, including murder, arson, setting a fire, and plotting a rebellion. Other crimes, such as stealing, were punished by whippings. Because slaves could not testify against whites, they had difficulty defending themselves, although records show that juries did sometimes find slaves not guilty. While owners had been able to grant or sell freedom to slaves before 1833, that was no longer allowed under the new code. Under the law, the legislature had to pass an act of specifically granting an individual slave his or her freedom. Some slave owners who wanted to free slaves joined the organization called the American Colonization Society, which sent freed slaves to a country it had bought in Africa called Liberia. With the law and law enforcement on the side of white slave owners, resistance to slavery was difficult and dangerous. Some acts of resistance were hidden, such as working slowly, pretending to be sick, breaking tools, or taking extra food. The most common open resistance was running away. Owners put ads in the newspapers describing runaway slaves. Women were less likely to flee because they did not want to leave their children behind, and hiding out with children was unlikely to be successful. In fact, most attempts at freedom were unsuccessful. Occasionally, slaves went beyond running away and planned full-scale revolts. In Augusta, a slave named Coco, or Coot, conspired in 1819 to set fires on two ends of the town. While whites were busy putting out the fires, he and his followers planned to raid the place where guns and ammunition were kept and take over the town. His revolt never happened because it was reported. He was arrested, found guilty, and hanged. The price for rebellion was his life. The most famous revolts were in other states. Nat Turner's revolt in 1831 in Southampton, Virginia, caused so much fear in slave owners throughout the South that most southern states passed new, stricter slave codes. Reviewing the section. 1. Define driver. 2. What was the gang system? The task system. 3. How did slaves resist slavery? 4. Why would religion have been so important in the life of a slave? Page 363, Georgia Portraits, William and Ellen Craft. Throughout the antebellum period, the yearning for freedom led many slaves to run away from their owners. Most were not successful, especially from a state as far south as Georgia. One of the most dramatic successful escapes, however, was a couple from the heart of the Cotton Belt in central Georgia, William and Ellen Craft. In 1860, they published the story of their incredible journey in Running 1,000 Miles to Freedom. Ellen Craft was the daughter of her slave owner and one of his slaves. Her mother also had white heritage, so Ellen was very light in skin color. She became a skillful seamstress and, at 11, became the seamstress for one of her white half-sisters in Macon. There she met the slave carpenter William, who could move around the town because he had permission to hire himself out. He was able to acquire some money because artisan slaves were often allowed to keep a small portion of the money they earned. Over time, one piece at a time, William bought clothing suitable for Ellen to dress as a young white male planter. Since she could not write, she put her arm in a sling. She bandaged her face as if she had a toothache so she would not have to talk much. She also pretended to be deaf. Her story was that she was going north for medical treatment. Accompanying this young planter was his faithful slave, William. The two managed to travel by train to Savannah, by boat to Charleston, and another boat to Wilmington, North Carolina. From there, they traveled by train to Philadelphia with a ferry ride across the Susquehanna River. They were often separated since William, as an African American, could not stay in cabins reserved for whites where Ellen was staying. They were almost stopped at the train connection from Baltimore to Philadelphia because Southern whites were not supposed to take slaves with them from the slave state of Maryland to the free state of Pennsylvania without proof of ownership. However, because Ellen was so convincingly disguised as a sickly young master, the two were allowed through. They arrived to freedom in Philadelphia on Christmas Day, 1848. They soon settled in Boston, Massachusetts, a stronghold of the abolition movement. After the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850, they had to flee again, this time to England, so they would not be recaptured and returned to slavery.